I'm staring at the eviction notice. I'm frozen, terrified. I'm thinking about Laura, my little daughter, and my baby who'll be born into homelessness. Today, I can tell you straight up, if it wasn't for Threshold and the people who donate to them, me and my girls would be homeless.
Threshold saves 9 families every day from homelessness. Please support our At Home for Christmas appeal. Help us stop homelessness before it happens.
Visit threshold.ie to make an instant Christmas donation.
Welcome to Reboot Republic, the podcast that goes behind the headlines and looks at the big issues in this republic of inequality. We are the podcast of solutions and the podcast of hope, and I'm your host, Rory Hearn. And today, I'm delighted to be joined by co-host Jana Lyons. Jana is, as you are probably well aware, listeners of Reboot Republic. She has been here before lots of times. She is a primary school teacher, trade union activist, and all-around great person, and an instigator of today's podcast, which is looking at the issue of COVID in schools. How, I suppose, really that question of how can schools actually be safe, and what could be done, what should be done. And we have a number of perspectives here, and my own perspective, of course, is as a parent of primary school children and secondary school children, it's all very challenging and it's all very difficult. And I think that what's very clear to me, and I'm delighted we have Orla Hegarty here, is that the real science needs to be followed and people's and children's and staff safety put first. But listen, I'm going to hand over to Jana now.
It's Rory. Thanks for having me back again. That's brilliant. Feels like we're around a table of old friends here. I think everyone has been involved with Reboot. Simon, is this your first foray into Reboot?
This is my first time. Yes.
You're very welcome. So on our panel this evening, we have Simon Lewis. Simon is a school principal and he also has his own podcast for onshut.net called If I Were the Minister for Education. So Simon, would you like to give a few words about what you cover on that podcast?
Yeah, no problem, Jana. The podcast is kind of pretty self-explanatory by its title. I take an issue around the education system at primary level, usually a controversial issue or just something that I'm slightly unhappy about. Anything from how we pay particular members of staff, all the way to bigger issues about patronage and things like that. And I basically argue what I would do if I were the Minister for Education each week.
Lots of good ideas. They're quite common sense, and yet they're not implemented for whatever unusual reason, that it's a mystery to all of us who are working on the ground. So yeah, we're looking forward to speaking to Simon later on about, I suppose, just your experience of being a school principal during COVID. And also, we're going to be talking a bit later on about the issue of far right organizing and how they are profiteering off people's very genuine misgivings, frustrations and concerns. Next, we have Carol and Linda. Carol and Linda have both been on Reboot previously. They are FORSA trade union members and they are both absolutely instrumental in the current campaign, which was launched on Saturday by FORSA Union, which is the Respect for SNAs campaign. So Carol and Linda, we're delighted to see you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And how did your campaign launch go on Saturday?
It was actually brilliant. I mean, Linda will tell you more, but it couldn't have gone better because Linda and Jesslyn Henry both came up with the idea of trending, and we got to number 2, I think, trending.
Yeah.
But I think more so we got just so much support from parents, teachers. It was just lovely. Mm-hmm. And we have a political briefing on Wednesday, which is a big deal, which I can tell you more about. But So that's things are going really well. We've got a lot of support. Yeah.
It's brilliant. I mean, it's such a no-brainer, isn't it? I don't know how anyone could speak against it. But look, yeah, we'll tease that out a little bit more in a while. After that, then, we also have we'll be speaking about the COVID measures in schools generally. And we had hoped to have some representatives here from the group Parents United. They weren't available this evening, but they did send on some feedback that they would like us to share. So we'll be sharing that. And as well as that, then when we're speaking about ventilation in schools, who else could we have on the podcast but Orla Hegarty, fresh off the RTE news this evening as we're recording this, the 6th of December. So Orla, it's great to have you here as well. Again, thank you so much for your time. And yeah, I suppose we'll just be speaking all things ventilation and these mysterious HEPA filters and why we're not seeing them in schools yet. Yeah, and then after that, I suppose just anything else that kind of pops into our head that maybe we didn't get to cover earlier on, and then we'll close, and hopefully we'll all be in bed before 10 p.m. this evening. But
holy moly, how long are you going to talk for? 10 p.m. It's only quarter to nine. These podcasts.
We don't have school tomorrow. We're allowed to stay up late.
We're allowed to stay up till half 10.
Yeah, I can see all the smiling faces. My face isn't smiling. I have to now go, how the hell am I managing these two little maggots in the morning?
Give me a call, Rory. I'll sort them out.
Put us on Zoom. You'll be fine.
Yeah.
Oh no, that gives me the real sense of fear when you say that.
That's flashbacks, isn't it? That's a trigger. That's true. Yeah. Okay. So, Simon, we might come to you first. So, like, I know it's a very broad question, but how has your experience been, say, even since like October midterm? So the contact tracing was removed from schools. Schools were left on to fend for themselves for a few weeks, and now the new antigen testing system is kind of in full swing. So how have you found it?
Thanks, Johnny. Yeah, I guess the best word I can really use is absolute carnage. I suppose that's two words though, isn't it? Yeah, September, I lost my job as a principal and became a full-time contact tracer, though I still kept my job as a principal more or less, but that's all I did. And then as soon as they removed contact tracing, it was amazing to see how COVID basically spread everywhere, you know, around my school. And I mean, as I'm talking to you now, we have we're still in the middle of our schools having lots and lots of cases. I had 12 staff who contracted COVID in the last month. And it's been awful. All of the cases have been put down by public health as community transmissions. Despite the fact that many of the parents in my school have written to me saying there's absolutely, you know, basically telling me that the situation was different, but ultimately there isn't anywhere to go. So, I mean, it's been a kind of a term so far of two halves. One with contact tracing, where we were able to kind of track things and keep things slightly under control, despite the fact that I didn't know none of my actual job. And then the after the contact tracing ended, where everything just went out of control, and I'm still not able to do my job. I haven't done a single educational thing really this term so far.
And are you finding that that's the same for colleagues in other schools? I'm sure you're in contact kind of informally.
Yeah, absolutely. And I suppose I've been fairly public and transparent about this, whereas I know many principals are find it, you know, I suppose they're scared in a way to kind of come out and say, look, we had to close a class down and send children home. I mean, that's happened in a lot of cases, but nobody wants to be on the front page of the Irish Times, the Irish Independent, whatever it might be. So effectively what they try and do is keep the head down, because inevitably, as we saw last month in Wexford, Vicky Barron was all over the newspapers, has ended up being on every radio show and everything else. And she doesn't have the time for it. And I mean, we don't have the time for all that really more so. And you just never know how your story is going to be, told. Once you've given it to a journalist. I mean, I find they've been great and very supportive, but I can understand why a lot of school principals, they don't like the gaze of the camera. They don't like all that sort of stuff. I mean, and I totally understand that.
Yeah, but, and like you're not media trained, and why would you be either? You know, a school leader wears so many hats. We know that the role hasn't been revised since, was it 1972 that the most recent circular came out?
Yeah, you're 1 year out. Just 1973 was when our contract was, when a principal's duties were last outlined. They included some very interesting things which are no longer relevant, but certainly one of them wasn't being a public health contact tracer in 1973. Yeah. That's certainly been added on.
And that leads us nicely on to, what I'm seeing from my point of view anyway, is the disrespect shown to principals by the Department of Education, you know, government and NEFET, who are now lip-zipped. They're no longer allowed to communicate. But it's like this morning wasn't the first example of guidance being published in the media prior to principals receiving it in their email inbox. Would that be fair to say?
Oh, it's absolutely more than fair to say. And that's been the case, I guess, I mean, for a very long time, even pre-COVID times. But I suppose what COVID did was actually got the media sort of very interested in education, or more so whether schools would remain open or not, rather than the education part of education. And there was a sort of running joke for the most of the first half of the lockdowns about how we used to get most of our information on a Friday evening just before 6 o'clock. And it was really difficult because, the job, as intense as it already is, became even more intense and even more challenging. And there, I mean, friends of mine, principals, have been sick. I mean, and not from COVID, from stress, but they still, have had to keep going. So, I mean, today's, missive, shall we say, was just, the usual kind of disrespect that I found out from RTE this morning. That last week's unbelievable, I would call the worst possible thing was last week around the mask wearing, that diktat, I think is what it's been known as, and then for it to be almost ignored that it happened, and this more I suppose softened stance that came this morning, it just, look, I mean, it's a circus in a way. And I also had a bit of a problem, I suppose, not relevant to this discussion around, in a way, NEFIT being silenced in a way as well. I found that very strange, as a situation that, like, what are we doing? We're laying the foundations for worrying times if we're, silencing people and, and controlling what the media say, all this kind of stuff. I'd have to say I'm a bit hypersensitive to this sort of stuff generally, but... Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, no, I think we'll definitely need to come back to how last week played out with the mask mandate, as it's being called, for third to sixth class, in a little while. Rory, did you want to come in there?
Yeah, just Simon, it's when you said there it's carnage, how, in terms of, I suppose, that the education process, you're saying you can't even focus on it. Like, how do you feel it's going for students and teachers at the moment? How is the engagement around the education, the morale, that whole idea of a school community? It must be very challenging.
It is. I said carnage because I didn't know whether I was allowed to swear on this podcast. So I had a different word.
It's all right. If you're frustrated enough, swear. It's okay.
Yeah, I try not to, but I may have to come back to that. I suppose what I've sensed really, from friends, colleagues, anyone involved in the education, it's a sense of being on edge all the time. I mean, I always say, my job as a principal, you're always, one second away from complete disaster. And that's in normal times, whereas, in a way, I feel that's across the board now, that you just, when you don't know what's going to happen next, or you're scared that, at any moment, your phone will ring or your phone will buzz to say there's been a confirmed case of COVID-19 in your class. And then there's the panic of, oh my gosh, I might have it. And just constantly being in fear of getting this, of getting bad news or and so on. So it's really, really difficult for, that's the staff point of view. And I mean, the children are being heroic, I think. And I hate that word, really, when I'm describing people, but they really have, most of them are getting on with it as best they can, and even the ones that aren't able to get on with it, like, because they're doing their darned hardest to get through it, because it's difficult. I'm a dad myself. I'm lucky. My own kid is fairly resilient. He's if a airplane crashed into the school tomorrow, he'd probably just go, look. And he'd be grand, but he wouldn't even notice. He'd be wondering what was for dinner. But like the thing,
God, you'll have to write a parenting book if that's the child you use. Fair play to you.
I need to make him a little bit more. I don't know what to say. But the thing is, in all seriousness, there are children that are really, really struggling with this, and they're not getting the supports they need at all. And I think we're going to pay a hefty price for, you know, the children that are coming to school that are scared. But then there's this hundreds of children that aren't in school still since March 2020, you know, for various reasons. I just think it's a scandal really is probably the only word to say on that. Nothing has been done for them.
Yeah, thanks, Simon. And I think that's something that isn't really spoken about in the media. You know, when you think about all the medically vulnerable families who are having to cocoon now, but they don't have the support system around them that was there in previous lockdowns as well. We might move on now, and we can come back to some of those points, but to Carol and Linda. So I suppose we'll just give you the floor. You're probably able to recite this in your sleep now at this stage, just to give us a sense of the campaign, where it came from, what your strategies are, what you're hoping to achieve from it, and hopefully a timeline as well. You know, I know that's a magic wand question, but over to you.
Do you want me to go first, Carol, or do you want to?
On you go, yeah.
So the basis of the Respect for SNAs campaign comes from, I suppose, a trip to the WRC with Forestry Trade Union sometime early this year, where they questioned the SNA scheme or contract began in 1979 and it hasn't changed since. And the minimum education requirement for anyone to become an SNA in Ireland at that time was 3 days in the junior cert. So I think we all know on this podcast that that was a very long time ago, and the junior cert actually isn't even there anymore. It's the junior cycle. So the basis of the campaign was to get that changed, because on the ground, like Simon and other principals, they aren't hiring on the basis of 3 days in the junior certificate. They're hiring on the basis of a higher caliber of staff, and that's what they want. And during last summer, I suppose, June, July, August, I was monitoring and stalking educationpost.ie, and 80 or 90% of the posts that went up, they were looking for higher than the minimum education requirement. So long went forced to WRC, and the Department of Education said they see no reason to change the minimum education requirement, which basically, in theory, one of our colleagues on the branch, Jessen Henry, works in a secondary school. She's working with Leaving Cert students. And basically what the department is telling her is that, no, we want you to be of 3 days in the junior cert to do your job. So effectively, somebody in transition year could do myself or Carol's job or any SNA in the country, which quite frankly is insulting compared to some of the educational achievements that many of us have. It's not to say that those that have worked as SNAs since 1979 with the minimum education requirement, they could write the book on becoming an SNA. But it's not fit for purpose, and it's not fit for those that are working as SNAs, and to keep us at such a low bar that we can't go like our teaching and principal colleagues and do continuous professional development, because they won't recognise anything that we do. So that was the whole basis of the campaign. Carol, do you want to talk about maybe Saturday or...
Yeah. And just another thing I'd add, because you covered everything there, but just it came up at the seminar on Saturday, 77% of SNAs have a level 5 and above, and 2.14 of the SNAs have stopped their education at junior cert. So really, you know, we're talking about a situation where it's the reality now is that we are qualified. It's not that we're saying we might. Mm-hmm. It's for new entrant SNAs. So we have respect for SNAs that are there 20, 30 years that didn't necessarily do the qualifications, they have the experience. But as you rightly said, like, we're doing things like peg feeding, hoisting, helping children with emotional and behavioural difficulties. It's so complex now in comparison to 1979. And we have adjusted and the department hasn't. So we had this seminar was organised by Forza on Saturday, and 800 people turned up. We had a few political representatives that turned up as well. Linda made a fantastic speech. And we had Noreen O'Mahony, she's chair. And it was just, It was very informative, but it was also a morale boost to see the support that we got and to have all the speakers and to just remind us again why we're doing this. Our contract, Jana, you mentioned timescale. Our contracts are due for renegotiation. I mean, it's not exactly linked to this call for a minimum requirement for education, but it's definitely, we want to professionalise and it's part of that. Yeah. And we've been told 18 months is the kind of the time frame for that to be renegotiated by the famous Andy Pike of Forza and his team.
Yeah, it's I think it's so important to give the space to you, and I appreciate Jana, you know, really highlighting that. We'd like to give it even more time, and it is something we will continue to highlight. And just because I think in many ways it does link directly in terms of your experience. Mm-hmm. Of COVID and how you feel within it. In a similar way that Jana asked, you know, Simon, do you feel disrespected? How do you feel within, you know, the I suppose, within the education system, within schools over the last couple of months? How has it been for SNAs?
Horrific. The last week or two in particular, in my particular school, like absolutely, like we're it's carnage, as Simon said. I have so many colleagues that are out. I have children that I would have cared for in the past out. I have children out as close contacts. We have no subs, or we have a sub and then that sub goes to another school and then contracts COVID. It's frightening because you're terrified to bring it home to your house. I have about 20 antigen tests in the corner that a neighbour gave me because they know that I work in a school. I'm sick of testing myself, but I'll keep doing it. Diabolical, I suppose, is like, and if you add to that the past 18 months for any education staff and the way that we've been disrespected by the minister, it's just, and the you know, the comments then at January and February when we last spoke, Rory, like, I mean, it hasn't got much better really. They don't acknowledge what the situation on the ground. I have children like Simon and Carol are in freezing cold classrooms. We're suffering majorly, and it's not like as small as violin singing the saddest song. It's actual. I actually said today for the first time to my sister that I know people on the front line have suffered and that they're, you know, feeling the effects or dealing with that. And I do actually worry because I'm looking at my colleagues that have never suffered with issues before. And I do think that we're all going to have something because it's not a normal amount of stress that you're dealing with. And it's only on a Friday evening. I think we said this, Carol, that when you can actually relax and that you've got through another week. And like, I'm in one school, I'm in a special class with six children. I have my daughter's in sixth class and my son's in junior infants. So it's three different schools. And then there's after school on top of that. So any week that I get through is a little week closer to nearly Christmas break. But I think we're all kind of edging on like deflation. The last time there was when contact tracing was removed and then when they said the antigen tests were coming for the TDs and we weren't getting it, like I've never experienced a mood like it in school. All of my colleagues, there was just silence at lunchtime the next day. It was just horrific. Like it's just actually so stressful to just go into work every day. And it's not the children that are stressing you out, it's the other situation. Like my principal has always remained calm and the last 2 weeks were all just defeat.
It's and just to add briefly to that, I mentioned to some of you before this, but I was diagnosed with COVID this morning. I've been sick for 3 days. I'm on a lot of meds, but you know, the contact tracer rang me this morning and I knew it was coming, but he said to me, you know, where are your contracts? I said, well, I've only one person. And he said, where do you work? I said, I work in a school. And he said, oh, well, there's no problem. So you work in a primary, so you don't need any more contact tracing. And I mean, it wasn't the contact tracer's fault. I just said gently, no, it's not okay. Like, you know, it's not right. And it feels like we've been abandoned.
Yeah. And that's why I sent out a very angry tweet with a curse word earlier, because I couldn't say that it was Carol, but I am so sick of talking to SNAs and principals and teachers all around the country, and they are fucking sick. They're sick, and our government and the Department of Education made us sick because they put us in situations where health and safety was at risk. and our children's health and safety. And I think I've said it 101 times, but like, may that be the rock this government perish on, because housing is one thing, Rory, and I know you're very passionate about that. But the fact that now they've thrown the vulnerable, who are the children, the only unvaccinated cohort left in the country, besides the people that don't want to get the vaccine. And like, may us never forget this, because I've never experienced anything like it. My son started junior infants in September. He did 4 full days and was a close contact. And 9 out of, we'd say, the 12 classes in the school went out in the following 2 weeks.
Yeah, it's horrific. It really is. And it is that sense of, you know, that sense and the feeling and reality of being abandoned is really, really wrong. You know, and to go through that. And I'm really sorry for you, Carol. It's very, very difficult. And you know,
I think, you know, as a rep, just the last thing on this, but as a rep, you know, I have SNAs contacting me. And my first thought, and I'm not making myself out to be some martyr, is that I work with a child that's medically vulnerable. And what if I gave it to her? No.
And that just sums up the role of the SNA. If nothing else could, you know, you're like, your first thought is back to the child that you're working with every day. That just sums it up.
Yeah,
you know, it's a special person that goes into
probably that we should never have had to deal with. You know, I just think that the removal of contact tracing, I'm certain you'll come back to it, it was just horrific.
And the CO2 monitors that I think they bought from Wish, because mine never changes. I'm pretty sure they bought them on Wish, and that's a sticker on the front of my monitor, because I have moved that bad boy around and nothing happened. So I think they bought it on Wish, 100%. Yeah.
That actually leads us very nicely into speaking to Orla Hegarty. Orla, like, what would your opinion be of the CO2 monitors? We hear now that there's funding coming for the HEPA filters. I think it's the first time there has ever been parity between a grant paid to primary and to post-primary schools, as was noted by some of my colleagues today. What's your general sense of how we're doing on ventilation?
How are we doing? Well, sorry, maybe just could I comment on the numbers and the scale of this? Maybe,
of course.
Because I've been looking at the data as well. I find it horrifying to look at the numbers, because I don't think they're getting a lot of media attention. 1,000 children a day now are having a positive PCR test. Like 1 in 40 of all primary school children has had a positive test in the last 2 weeks, which means they're out of school, which means their siblings and their parents are disrupted as well. The other one that I think is really shocking is just in the last couple of days, we've reached 100,000 children with a positive PCR test. So that's, you know, a fraction of the actual infected children if they've had symptoms and gone and had a test. So it's probably double that. But of the 100,000, 50,000 of them were up to the 13th of September this year, and 50,000 have been in the last 12 weeks. So, you know, that's a really shocking statistic. Like, for a year and a half of pandemic, we had 50,000 children. And then in 12 weeks, we've had 50,000 children with a positive test. And this is all obviously with Delta. And we're on course, somebody else has done a statistic that we're on course for 1 in 40 or 1 in 50 of all children to be isolating at Christmas. So, you know, it isn't hospitality that took one for the team. You know, it's terrible that people are out of work, and it's awful that they've no money. But that can be fixed with money. Yeah, like, it's children who've taken one for the team. That can't be fixed with money. This is their health and their future education and ability to be well enough to go to school and have, you know, a life where they are healthy. They're being infected on such a scale now. It's just shocking. Mm-hmm. So what I've been trying to do, I suppose, for quite some time is to highlight the scale of it, and also, you know, going back to last spring to look at preventions for this autumn, because it was really, really obvious by last March, that statistically you couldn't get out of this with just vaccination. There aren't enough adults in the country to get out with vaccination. But also, we don't have vaccines that stop people getting this disease. We just have vaccines that are volume control that'll turn down your symptoms and hopefully keep you out of hospital. So that means that people are still spreading it even when they're vaccinated. And I spoke at the Oireachtas Health Committee in May and spoke about all of this, that it needed a prevention plan in parallel or the vaccine program would be wasted. If it didn't have the support. And the really key piece of that was children, because they wouldn't be vaccinated. One in five of the population goes to school every day. Almost half of households have somebody going out to school every day. And if you didn't protect schools and children, we wouldn't be able to control this. And it has played out exactly as was warned, that and then it was made worse by taking away contact tracing in schools so that people didn't even know if there was infection in the class and there was no attempt to contain it. And I suppose, yes, CO2 monitors were given to schools, but I don't think they were given very good information about how to use them or what to do. But, you know, a CO2 monitor is like a smoke alarm in some ways in that it tells you of a problem, but then you need to deal with the problem. Mm. And, you know, there's a huge variety of schools. And it's clear, you know, from my research on nursing homes that it is the building, you know, because you get hotspots and you get places that are fine, consistently fine. And, you know, and the same with schools. You get schools that have repeated outbreaks and you get some schools that have been okay. And, you know, that's not hand sanitizer. That's not the community, because sometimes the two schools are in the same community. You know, I think we've, you know, the talk of schools are safe and, you know, and it's the community. It doesn't stand up to any evidence. Every other country in the world has recognized that schools are a risk and they need particular precautions. And we're an outlier in not dealing with it, apart from us and the UK. And the UK policy comes from a political position of let children get infected and get it over with, which is completely immoral. And
well, you could argue that that's the policy here in all but name.
You could. It hasn't been explicitly said here, so I'm not going to say that it is the policy here, but it is the policy in the UK and we can see what's happened. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't stop at 2% of children being infected, which is what we have now. At the same time, in the UK, it has gone to 4% and 5% and 9%. In secondary school children at one stage. And in Russia, it went to 12% in communities. So it doesn't stop where we are now at 2%. It gets worse. And it feeds back into the community. It brings, you know, it means vulnerable children are excluded from school and education. It means families are second-class citizens because they can't engage in society on the same level as people who feel they're safer. It's been a very poor policy, but it's a human rights issue that I see it. You know, there's a human rights issue here that children have a right to participate in decisions about them and they have a right to a safe education. And we also have human rights commitments, actually, in Ireland that the state will protect people from epidemic and endemic disease. And so that's part of the picture, I think, as well. But in a long-winded way to get to ventilation, most of my work from the beginning was about how does this transmit? Like, how does it go from one person to the other? It can only travel in space, you know, so it's a spatial thing. And we know that outdoor transmission is very low. It'd be very close to somebody. So it's all about the buildings. It's all about the trapped air in spaces. And that's all very manageable, actually. Well, manageable in that you can measure it and then you can deal with it. And the entire pandemic is related to trapped air in vehicles and buildings. But unfortunately, environmental science has been very much excluded from policy. Those of us knocking on doors and talking to everybody we can for the last year and a half have been very, very frustrated by the kind of science denial, I suppose, of not engaging with this and actively denying that this is a science, you know. And you know, and like, to go back into it, I mean, today I was at a school that was designed in the TB era, where they've had a very successful dealing with the pandemic. Every classroom is cross ventilated and all the circulation is outside. But you know, you can go back further. I mean, I've records from 1850 in America where they were measuring CO2 in glass tubes and going back to the lab, and they were doing it in Spanish flu in America. And obviously here we were designing buildings for disease control, housing as well, hospitals, and Florence Nightingale was doing it. This is not new science. This is very old science that has kind of fallen out of use.
And it's tried and tested. So why aren't they implementing?
I struggle with that all of the time. You know, I mean, it's not even that people don't know now. People do acknowledge it's airborne. That's taken a long time to even get them to use the word. But now that there are solutions being presented and not taken. I think it's unconscionable, you know, not to work. I mean, not to work with everybody who can do something and not to let them access it. Because at the end of the day, if we all breathed clean air for 2 weeks, we wouldn't have a pandemic. You know, that's just the maths of it. You don't, it's very rare that you would catch it from surfaces, and they haven't even documented any cases. So,
and yet the amount of money that we've spent on hand sanitizer in schools, but they can't seem to find apparently. The money. Can't seem to find the money for the HEPA filters. Would you be able to give like a HEPA for dummies kind of synopsis of, I mean,
yeah. It's very simple. I mean, I've used the kind of comparison with a fish tank before. You know, if you have fish in a tank, the water will get really cloudy, but you'll see it in water. And so people will either refresh the water, so you'll replace it with clean water, which is a bit like opening windows because you're bringing in clean water and getting rid of it. Or the other way is to put a filter in your fish tank and the water is flowing through that all the time and it's taking all of the particles and dirt out of the water. So it's the same kind of thing. I mean, obviously, we can ventilate rooms. Our building standards are not adequate to a public health crisis like this in terms of ventilation. They probably aren't adequate for public health, probably anyway, because they're kind of compromised by energy saving and not prioritized for human health. So, but that's sort of beside the point. So it means that we are now in a situation of where we're trying to ventilate buildings a lot, and that in cold weather is really uncomfortable. It's okay in the summer, which is why cases drop in the summer. We keep very comfortable with the windows open. So filtration is very well proven. It's been around for a very long time. Hospitals use filtration because they do surgery and other procedures. Places that manufacture computer chips and medical devices and antibiotics and all those things that are used in hospitals are manufactured in clean rooms that have HEPA. Airlines use it because they recirculate the air on flights. So this has been, this is well proven and it's been around. The reason it's suitable for schools is schools are very densely occupied. You know, you put a lot of people into a room and you leave them there for quite a long time. So like in a church, everybody's left in an hour. In a shop, everybody's moving through short amounts of time. But children will be in close proximity so they can hear the teacher and they'll be there for 5 or 6 hours. So they're known to be a very high risk building that needs special precautions.
And with that as well, sorry to interrupt, but you know, it's not chalk and talk the way that school was in 1973 when that circular about a principal's job was made. You know, there's such a focus on oral language. We have a new language curriculum in primary schools. It's all about eliciting the children's thoughts. They're talking all the time, whether it's in group work or whole class. And obviously that's going to increase the CO2 and the spread in the room as well.
Yeah, the activity is very important. And in fact, it's a bit disappointing in the guidance that came out today that they talk about taking off masks for singing and instruments and lunch, which are probably the three highest risk activities, and PE. You know, I mean, if anything, they're the ones that need really, really special precautions. Firstly, singing is a major risk factor. There's been a lot of choir super spread events. And that's partly because somebody singing is putting a lot of more into the air, and partly because people who are singing with them are deep breathing and they're bringing it deep into their lungs. So choirs are very risky. And same with, playing the tin whistle. Somebody who's infected is blowing this around the room. And PE, you're breathing a lot more, you breathe a lot more when you're doing something like exercise. Gyms are high risk as well. And then the lunchtime, because as you know, the kids kind of sit face to face and they take off masks and they're all chatting. So lunch has always been identified as an issue. And in fact, one of the pieces of advice from America was to just take off masks for 10 minutes to eat and put a video on so that they don't talk while they're eating, because that makes a big difference in risk. Obviously spreading them out or eating outside is better. But if you can't do that, that they're not face to face, that they're shoulder to shoulder and that they maybe watch a video and they're all looking the same way. And then you ventilate out the whole room and try and clear it. So there's loads of things that are small things that people can do.
And Orla, just a question, and it's something that surprisingly got not much coverage as far as I've heard. Maybe Jana and Simon could tell me different, but the whole issue of our class sizes and the fact that we are one of the largest in Europe, to me, is that a factor in the spread of it here, the fact that we do have overcrowding in so many classrooms?
I'd say it is. I mean, we do have one of the most overcrowded issues with classes in Europe, as far as I'm aware.
It's actually the highest.
Yeah, of course it is, because like the risk in a room is actually a factor of the volume of air, you know, because we all, you can calculate how much people breathe. We breathe about 8 litres a minute, and you can calculate the number of people in the room and they're all breathing 8 litres, and you can work out the volume of the room. So the bigger the room, obviously, you know, the risk is a factor of how many people and how much air. And that's why historically rooms for large amounts of people had very high ceilings, like cathedrals and, you know, schools that were built in earlier eras often had very high ceilings, and hospital wards and things. And that was to do with air and the volume of air. We've now built classrooms that are quite small. Lots of them only have windows on one side, so it's hard to get cross ventilation. You know, corridors are crowded then with children all coming out of class at the same time. So each school really needs to sort of understand this, and then they can take action. You know, maybe they stagger the break times, maybe they do lunches differently, maybe the kids in sequence get to have the hall and sit on mats and eat their lunch watching a video. You know, if the day isn't good, the tin whistle is definitely outside, the exercise is outside, and you know, so there's lots, I think there's lots of people understand. And then there's an issue around transport as well, you know, where you could advise parents about car sharing and having lifts and buses and those things again, which are hotspots.
Just on that, Orla, I suppose, like, from, I know for my school anyway, and I, from all the colleagues that I've spoken to, all of those things that you've listed, like the staggered break times and everything else, like we are implementing all of those things. And I think school staff haven't got enough credit for how we've all had to our style of teaching. You know, it wasn't the hand sanitizer that saved us.
I think the schools have been incredible. And, you know, when they say we weren't seeing outbreaks in school, well, I mean, obviously there have been, but I think it could have been a million times worse actually in 2020 if it hadn't been for teachers sitting in cold classrooms all last year.
Like I'm thinking of the fact that we were all in a hard lockdown last January, February, and they were actually colder months than last December. I dread to think what schools are going to be like in January, February this year coming.
Absolutely.
If we don't have
schools are going to be like, they're going to be closed again. Like if they don't do something now and we all go and have Christmas, that's, it's going to be an absolute repeat, and they have nobody to blame but themselves because they didn't give us the adequate safety measures to keep them open. And
well, the ironic thing is, you know, even if people don't think it's about children, which it is, even if they don't, like this is driving the pandemic. This is 1 in 5 of the population who are exposed every day potentially. And you know,
well, look, I think we can all agree that if recorders and tin whistles don't make their way back into primary schools, we'll be making a lot of parents and staff happy.
Lighted if we've no tin whistle practice.
Yeah, it's not the most pleasant noise now, I have to say, when I'm walking down to my lunch and I hear the screeching coming, echoing blissfully from upstairs. Look, we'll have to move on. Orla, I know you might need to shoot off, so just thank you so much for your time.
I'll duck out now.
And your expertise.
Thanks for the invitation.
Very much appreciated. So look, we're going to come back to Simon now. I was chatting with Tony and Martin on the Sunday show this week, just in response to a small cohort, and it needs to be said that it is a really exceptionally small minority of education staff, but ones who are organizing, against that mask mandate that was, I suppose, kind of foisted on everybody mid last week. And I use that word because it happened after office hours. It wasn't on headed paper from the Department of Education. There was no signature attached to it for, an assistant secretary from the department. It wasn't written down in a circular, which are obviously, legal instructions for boards of management to follow. And there's a small group of people who have been, I suppose, profiting from and feeding off the very genuine anger, fear, misgivings, distrust that people have of, you know, government and NPHET. It feels like the leadership has gone, and people are very understandably going to be, I suppose, look, they're easy targets. I was much more eloquent when I was talking to the lads on Sunday, but I think there are people who have very genuine confusion and need reassurance. And what happens always is that the far right, when we need to call it out for what it is, especially people like myself, others who are, you know, white settled, I don't face any personal threat to this. I've actually spoken to colleagues today who have to keep a low profile, or they have had to withdraw from the conversation for their own personal safety. But it struck me. I watched some footage of the mask protest that happened outside the Dáil on Friday. And like, a lot of the people there are really being swept along with this fear mongering that's going on. And it's kind of turning into a culture war. As I was talking with the lads on Sunday, that it's quite symptomatic of us being an individualistic society that's much more closely aligned with what's happening in America and has been transpiring since 2016, in comparison with the Asian countries where mask wearing is just the done thing and has been for a very long time, because it's seen as, you know, we all look out for each other, we all protect each other. Now, Simon, I know you put out a very powerful podcast a few days ago, and I would really encourage everybody after they finish listening to this to take the hour and listen to that, because you yourself have had a very negative experience with some of the key players who I suppose are organizing. So I don't know how much you'd like to speak about that, or even just like if you wanted to take that aside, but talk with your school principal hat on about how did that play out last week when you yourself and your colleagues got that diktat, as you called it, out of hours? You know, how did that go for you the next day in school?
Yeah, sorry, I'm quite happy, I suppose, to talk about why I suppose I would be, let's say, hypersensitive to this kind of thing. I can assuredly say that I am the only primary school principal in the country from a minority background. I'm not from a Christian household. I wasn't raised in a Christian faith, and I somehow managed to get a teaching job despite all the odds being against me. But I was raised in the Jewish community. I went to a Jewish school. I did all that. So I've seen how, you know, from a different faith perspective, you know, the kind of polarization that can happen. And I guess being from a Jewish background, I suppose I can be even more hypersensitive to, let's say, when you see right wing ideology being thrown around, you know, where, you know, you're looking at people using words like apartheid and Holocaust and all this kind of stuff, you know, in a way to nearly undermine the real meanings of those words, and using them in a way to bring people along because they know they're bad things. And I've been following this sort of, and as I said, it is a very, very small minority. I mean, tiny minority of people involved in this. I suppose in every society, there's going to be small groups that are going to be, that will swing to the right, no matter what the profession is, and teaching would be no different, or the world of education would be no different, as you've seen, even there's some quite well known third level people out there that have gone that way, I suppose when I got that that's note on Tuesday or Wednesday evening, I can't remember the day, they sort of blurred into each other. It's quite stressful, to be honest. I just knew this was going to be a massive victory for that element of education, because it fed very much into the narrative that, you know, the government and NPHET are trying to control the population. They're trying to mask our children. They're trying to, you know, this kind of thing. Next, what will be the next thing? And this question that's always asked, where will it all end? and they don't want you to answer that question. They want you to think of your worst possible thing in your imagination, whatever that might be. And I mean, it was interesting to me because, as I said, I've been following one of these groups who were very, very small up until about 2 or 3 weeks ago, maybe a dozen members. They shot up to over 400 members within 24 hours of that diktat going out. And I noticed Facebook friends of mine joining it. And, you know, interestingly, one anyway, vulnerable to some of their other agendas. You know, I mean, these groups aren't going, I mean, they may be going on an anti-mask, anti-vax stance at the moment, but they also have other stances which are much more sinister. They're very well known for, some of their members are very well known for their anti-LGBT plus stances and have been seen at protests, you know, at various events. You know, I don't want to give them any publicity particularly, but they worry me. You know, they do worry me.
It is very worrying, Simon. And I think, like, I was quite struck. I wasn't surprised by the size of the protest on Friday. But I am well aware, and I know people are pointing it out to me, that, you know, the far right are in there. They are manipulating it. And this is very worrying and very dangerous. And there's no doubt that the absolute failure of communication, of, you know, what you talked about, the failure of leadership and government and department, you know, to offer and to consult and to engage, you know, and engage parents in particular as well, you know, along with the schools, you know, to, you know, they are stakeholders. We are stakeholders as well. And we're, you know, completely ignored as well, you know, in terms of the communication. And there's not that engagement. It is absolutely, as you said, diktat. And within that context, then you have this absolute playing on vulnerability. And it's deeply dangerous because, you know, we know people are really suffering. You know, you've set it out today. People are suffering across society from COVID in so many ways, feeling isolated, and people are very vulnerable and very open to manipulation right now. So I'm really glad you raised that, and you spoke very, I think, powerfully there. And I think it's a really important message we need to understand. And again, put that message out there that, you know, we need to try and figure this out together as a society. And we have to really avoid, as we have said before on these podcasts, the them and us, the anti-teacher, the anti, you know, parent, this, you know, this, we're all in this together in terms of all of us. It is failure from the top, you know, on communication and valuing that is the problem. But Simon, we'd love to get you back on to talk about that in more detail. And to Carol and to Linda as well, in terms of, we'll have you back on again soon. It was really lovely to have you back again. It's so important. And, you know, it's, again, it reminds me, and thank you to Jana for organizing this podcast. You know, it reminds me of, you know, how we are a community, because obviously I'm being a parent, you know, I am an educator at third level, but, you know, you really feel and you realize, you know, you hear SNAs and you hear teachers, and we've become in COVID so disconnected from our, you know, like, you know, I remember pre-COVID, you would be in a class chatting to the teacher, you would be, you know, you'd know the SNAs much better, whereas now it's so disconnected, you know. And in that context, we're in this situation, which we've never been in, this pandemic, and we're more in many ways divided or, you know, are disconnected, but we have to really work harder then to try and keep connected together across. And I really appreciate all of you coming on. Jana, do you want to?
No, you said it all. And as Linda said earlier, like, none of us have ever experienced being under this level of sustained stress for such a long time before, you know, so that needs to also be acknowledged for why people are venting their frustrations, or maybe following those groups who are, you know, organizing and taking advantage of, as I said, genuine concerns. But, you know, and I'm seeing this in my own family. I've family members who have very unfortunately, you know, fallen down the rabbit hole, for want of a better word. But I would encourage people, you know, if you have those opinions about your child wearing a mask in school, like, that's fine. I'm not going to change your opinion. But I would always urge people to look at the source of who is organizing the events and the protests that you are aligning yourself with. You know, and this, I'm even saying this as someone on the left, you know, I was, actively pro-choice for many years before repeal. And that was always something that you needed to take into account. Like, yes, they might be having the same broad objective as what you would align yourself with, but you need to look at who is actually behind it. And I think that has something that has possibly been lost. And maybe that's because, you know, there's a whole sector of society that are now being mobilized into grassroots action that don't have prior experience of it. And they're getting that feeling of the togetherness. They're getting that feeling of we can achieve something here. But it's looking a little bit deeper into who is organizing this, who is orchestrating this. Mm. And de facto, who am I aligning myself with here, even if I don't agree with other stances that they have on different issues. But Rory, thank you so much for allowing us this space to thrash it out. You know, it's all of us are active on Twitter, but you know yourself, you don't get to really tease things out in such detail.
No, absolutely not. And I really like to come back to it again soon, because it is something I think as we've gone through the pandemic, it's something that quite easily slips off the headline. And I was really struck by what Simon, what you were saying about why principals don't speak out and the pressures and the difficulties, and they're very real. And the part of the problem is when people aren't speaking in the public media, the voice isn't heard. And so the issue isn't heard. And I think that is something that hopefully this, you know, this space, again, we come back to this podcast, can offer. But listen, thank you to all of you for being here this evening.
Thanks and thank very you much for the opportunity. Thank
yeah,
you.
Thanks a million.
Thanks, Rory and Jana.
And Jana, why don't you're a patron of Reboot Republic and the Tortoise Shack. We are an independent media. Tony Groves, thank you, Tony, for producing. Tony does the production. Without Tony, this wouldn't exist. And we really, you know, encourage you and thank you, patrons who are
supporters. Everyone has frozen.
Who's frozen? Did I freeze or did
Oh, everyone froze. That was comedic timing. Comedic timing.
Everybody froze. Everybody froze.
I didn't froze me.
Jana, do you want to close out? And why should somebody become a patron of
It's the cost of an expensive cup of coffee, as I've heard many times, even though I don't drink coffee myself. Look, the podcasts are out on Spotify and all other, you know, streaming services if you so choose. But what I do really love having them in my email inbox. And it's like that you can't be more up to date than when a podcast has just been recorded and then Tony clicks publish, you know. And there's like when I think about the breadth of topics that are covered on the various different podcasts that you have, like, I think it's worth it for Reboot alone. I'm not only saying that because Rory is here with me and he has my brown envelope in the post, but it's, you know, it's like, where else are you going to get people affected by the issues being raised, or people where that's their, you know, their mastermind subject as such? You know, you've got Rory with housing, you've got Vicky doing policed for the policing system in Ireland, and then, you know, current affairs with Tony and Martin as well. So I promise I wasn't paid to say any of that, but
no, and of course Caroline as well.
Absolutely. I was listening
with
to Caroline earlier.
All her wonderful Glow West sex and all the stuff in between and over and above and all of it. Brilliant. Brilliance as well. But yeah, absolutely. No, please go over to patreon.com/tortoiseshack. Sign up whatever you can and help us keep this show on the road. And thank you very much, everybody. And we'll talk to you all soon.